Welcome to Crime Lapse. I am Eileen.
And I'm Charlie.
On the coast of the South Island of New Zealand sits a small city that is referred to as the country's own Edinburgh. It's a stunning place to live, with inhabitants from all over the globe residing amongst rolling hills and a beautiful harbour. Although it's now a modern, bustling city, it's managed to retain its Victorian charm and is home to New Zealand's oldest university, the University of Otago. In 2008, a graduate of the university was brutally murdered before she was due to start her new life. The case highlighted the outdated legal defence of provocation and brought much-needed change to the country.
On January 9th, 2008, a woman called 111, the emergency services line. While on the call, she can be heard desperately trying to open her daughter's locked bedroom door. She can hear a rhythmic thumping sound from inside of the room, and she's panicking. She manages to open it and screams, "He's killed her," before the door can be heard slamming shut. The call handler told her to leave the house, which she did, only making it to the end of the drive before she collapsed in despair. Constable John Cunningham was the first officer on the scene of what he initially thought to be a domestic dispute. Outside the house, he saw the woman who'd called 111 hysterically crying on the driveway, as the woman cried out that her daughter was killed in her bedroom and the man who did it was still there. Constable Cunningham wasted no time in running straight inside and up the stairs. He identified himself and told the person to unlock the door, or he would kick it in. Then he heard the door being unlocked. As he opened the door and stepped inside, he could see the body of a young woman on the floor. She was covered in blood. The room was drenched in blood. And juxtaposed next to the chaotic scene stood a calm man. Constable Cunningham asked him what he'd done, and he simply said, "I killed her." He complied with the officer's order to lie face down on the floor and was asked why he'd killed her. He said, "The emotional pain she's caused me over the past year." He told the officer he'd used a knife and that it probably was underneath the victim. The officer saw a pair of scissors between the woman's legs and her killer said, "I used them at the end." Outside of the house, paramedics and other emergency responders were rushing to see what could be done. The man, now handcuffed, was asked whose blood was all over his arms, legs and face, and he replied, "A little bit of mine, mostly hers." He was then asked who he'd killed and he said, "It's Sophie Kate Elliott, 11th of June 1985. The dead-end street was now filling up with police cars and St John's ambulances. The first paramedic who went inside came back out shortly after. Nothing could be done. Sophie Elliott was dead, and her mother, Leslie, had witnessed it all. Sophie was the youngest child of Leslie and Gil Elliott. She was adored by her older brothers, Nick and Chris, both of whom were living in Australia, and she was about to embark on her own journey, flying the nest. She had lived at home in Ravensbourne, Dunedin. Her father worked away a lot, managing the medical diagnostic laboratory in Dunstan Hospital, almost 200 kilometres away. And she was exceptionally close to her mother, who worked as a neonatal nurse at Dunedin Hospital. Sophie had always been intelligent. There was a bit of an age gap between her and her brothers, so she was usually around people older than her, and had no trouble keeping up. When she left secondary school in 2003, her principal, Christine Layton, said, "Sophie's energy is boundless. Her determination to do well is very strong, as is her outstanding work ethic. Her independence of thought marks her maturity." Sophie carried herself with confidence. She knew what she wanted from life and she wasn't afraid to work hard to get it. The ethics instilled by her parents were matched by her own learned experiences to make her into the person that she was. She was a high achiever, a great dancer, a good singer, a talented photographer, and a fantastic daughter, student, and friend. She completed her studies at Otago University in 2007, obtaining a first-class honours degree, a result of her hard work and tenacity. She'd applied for a role as a graduate analyst at the New Zealand Treasury, an impressive job that she was offered almost immediately. She was due to begin working in January 2008 in Wellington. It was away from her hometown, friends and family. It was a fresh start, exactly what she needed.
In the summer of 2007, while in her final year, Sophie began seeing someone, Clayton Weatherston, her economics tutor. Although he was 10 years her senior and didn't seem to have much in common with Sophie, she seemed happy. Her mother, Leslie, first heard about Weatherston when she was getting ready to go with Leslie for her interviews in Wellington. Sophie told her that one of her tutors had offered to accompany her. Leslie thought this was strange, but Sophie thought it was a nice gesture. She went with her mum anyway. Sophie had first begun seeing Weatherston a few weeks earlier. She'd been working late in the university and Weatherston asked her to go for dinner. Already there were red flags for Sophie's mother. The dynamic between a tutor and a student should hardly be romantic. But Sophie assured her that Clayton Weatherston had made sure there would be no problems at the university. Within the space of a few months, Sophie and Weatherston had broken up more than a few times and reconciled just as many. Sophie was put off by his selfishness. She told her mother that during an evening walk, she told him she was cold, hoping that he would lend her his coat, as a gentleman would. But he just said, "I'd lend you my jacket, but then I'd be cold." He often came across as arrogant, but not many people saw any sign of aggression. Weatherston began berating Sophie and putting her down, insulting her looks, personality and intelligence, all the while seeking constant reassurance that he was the best man she had ever been with. Her self-esteem began to plummet, and she attended a counsellor. She went on holiday to Australia in November 2007 with her friend Jessica, and was putting Weatherston out of her mind. She spent Christmas with her family, having little contact with her ex, but she had photographed his graduation. He had recently gotten his PhD. She edited the photos and mounted them in an album, and then delivered them to him. He seemed more interested in trying to seduce Sophie than looking at the photos she had kindly brought. She rejected him and told him that she was moving to Wellington and that they were over for good. In a rage, he grabbed her and threw her onto his bed. He held her throat and covered her mouth as he climbed on top of her and screamed in her face. Terrified but strong, she managed to fight him off and ran out the door. Weatherston followed closely behind, and when she got to her car, he pulled the door open and shouted, "When you were flying back from Australia, I hoped the fucking plane would crash so you would be killed." Sophie sped off, and at work she told her colleagues what had happened. They urged her to report him to the police, but she knew she would be moving to Wellington in a couple of weeks, so she didn't feel like it was worth the hassle. On January 7, 2008, a few days before she was due to leave, she stopped by the university to give a gift to her supervisor. While walking through the halls, Weatherston saw her and asked her to come into his office to talk. Once there, he put his arms around her, which made her visibly nervous. When he asked her why, she told him it was because of what he had done the previous week. When he asked what she meant, she was furious and put her hand on his mouth and tried to grab his throat to demonstrate exactly what he had done. He pushed her away and she told him that her friends and her mother had urged her to report it to the police, and he replied that she had just assaulted him so he could file a complaint against her. She ran out of the office and down the stairs. Weatherston was close behind and was heard shouting by other staff members, but no one came to see why. He shoved Sophie, almost causing her to fall down the stairs, and told her that he was trying to give her his hate. She was distraught, and her mother tried to console her as they finished packing the last of her belongings for her move to Wellington. The following day, her car broke down as she was on her way to say goodbye to her friends, including her supervisor at the university, meaning she would have a lot more to do the next day, January 9th. Sophie and her mother spent the morning bringing boxes of her belongings downstairs in preparation for the removal van that was due to arrive that afternoon. Sophie had been getting ready when she noticed her mother in tears. When she asked what was wrong, Leslie told her that she would miss her so much. Sophie promised she would visit regularly and had already planned to be home for Easter in just a few months. At 12:15 p.m, there was a knock at the door. When Leslie answered it, she was greeted by a smiling Clayton Weatherston, who told her he had something for Sophie. Sophie, who was always immaculately presented, came to the stairs to see who it was. Her hair and makeup perfect, she was wearing a white shirt, a denim skirt, and a white cardigan. She hadn't been expecting to see Weatherston, but agreed to speak with him while she was packing in her room. He followed her upstairs and Leslie waited in the kitchen, not wanting to intrude but not feeling comfortable being out of earshot after the way Weatherston had grabbed her daughter a week or so previously. Sophie came downstairs within a few minutes and told her mother that she didn't know what Weatherston wanted, as he had just been sitting silently on her bed. Leslie told Sophie to get him to leave so she could finish packing and get ready to go with her friends that evening. She was supposed to be meeting friends for pizza on the beach. Sophie agreed and said he probably just wanted to leave things on good terms before she went to Wellington. She went back upstairs, not knowing that Weatherston was hiding behind her bedroom door. Leslie heard the door slam shut and Sophie screamed, "Don't, Clayton." She raced up the stairs and tried to get into the room, but the door was locked. She could hear a thumping sound and assumed that Weatherston was raping Sophie. She ran down to the kitchen to get a meat skewer, which could be used to unlock the door from the outside, and as she ran back, she dialed 111. As she struggled to get the door unlocked, she could still hear the thumping sound, and as much as she feared her daughter was being sexually assaulted, nothing could have prepared her for what she saw when she got the door open. Clayton Weatherston was straddling Sophie's lifeless body on the floor, repeatedly stabbing her with the knife in his right hand while he slammed the door shut with his left. Police arrived shortly after and arrested Clayton Weatherston. Leslie was distraught and alone outside the house. She knew Sophie was gone. The paramedics asked her to go to the hospital, but she refused, not wanting to be far from her beloved daughter. Her friend and brother came to be with her soon after. Gil was still working away, so he was called to the office by the hospital CEO. Waiting for him were two police officers who broke the horrific news that his only daughter had been killed in her bedroom. He was driven the two-hour journey to be by his wife's side by police officers. Leslie's brother told their son Nick what had happened, and one of Chris's friends went to tell him. Their home was now a crime scene. Instead of meeting friends at 6 p.m. as she had planned, Sophie's murder was the headline story on the evening news. Reporters had lined the police cordon, taking photographs of the increasing police presence as they collected evidence. Leslie and Gil were sent to a motel next to the police station, where their daughter's murderer was being held. It was too much for them to bear, and they moved to a motel further away, where they had to stay for the next few weeks. It was here that they had to plan Sophie's funeral, away from their home, their comfort, the place where they had made memories with their daughter. They were unable to get their clothes or belongings until after. On January 15th, Sophie should have been settling into her new life in Wellington. Her funeral service was held in St. Hilda's Collegiate School in Dunedin, in the chapel. Sophie had went to school there for 7 years and achieved great academic success, even becoming joint proximity accessit. Her brother Chris played the piano and performed a song, "The Other Side" by David Gray, at the ceremony. The pews were packed with people devastated by the untimely loss of such an incredible young woman. Among those who paid tribute to Sophie were longtime friends, former teachers, principals, supervisors, and her heartbroken parents. Her blue casket, which had been painted to depict scenes of mountains, was carried by her brothers and four of her friends. As she was brought out, the crowd released 99 red balloons into the sky. A single red balloon was found in the school library, and when it was released again, it managed to float back inside. Her online obituary contains a poem titled "The Broken Chain." It reads, "We little knew that day God was going to call your name. In life we loved you dearly, in death we do the same. It broke our hearts to lose you, you did not go alone, for part of us went with you, the day God called you home. You left us beautiful memories, your love is still our guide, and although we cannot see you, you are always at our side. Our family chain is broken and nothing seems the same, but as God calls us one by one, the chain will link again."
Weatherston appeared in court on January 10th, 2008, and was charged with murder. He was remanded into custody, and there was a publication ban on his name. This was lifted a week later, and he was further remanded. A deposition date was scheduled for May of that year. In March, there was a memorial service held at the University of Otago's Marama Hall. Tributes to Sophie were paid, and it was announced that there would be an annual economics prize set up in her honour. A cherry blossom was planted for Sophie, with a plaque bearing her name beneath it. Sophie never got the chance to attend her own graduation, but her brother Chris was allowed to accept her degree on her behalf. It was the first time in the university's almost 140-year history that a degree was awarded in person under the circumstances, and Sophie's family felt very grateful, adding that they were going to have a large celebration because it was what Sophie would have wanted. In May, trial proceedings began. An initial deposition was held over the course of 4 days. Attorneys Marie Grills and Robin Bates were to represent the Crown prosecution, with Judith Ablett-Kerr and Greg King, the defence counsel. Leslie Elliott was subpoenaed to testify and so could not attend the first arguments. The Crown prosecutor detailed Sophie's murder and revealed for the first time to the court that she had been stabbed at least 216 times. Weatherstone would be pleading not guilty, with a defence of provocation, meaning that he felt as though he was not responsible for killing Sophie as he felt as though she had provoked him. Leslie testified about the afternoon of the murder. She said that after she'd managed to get inside of Sophie's bedroom, she found Clayton on top of her, just stabbing her lifeless body. She stated, "He was straddled across her legs, and she had blood around her neck. The whole room to me seemed like it was red." She said that when she first heard her daughter screaming from the bedroom, she'd feared that she was being raped. It never even crossed her mind that she was being murdered. Clayton's defence attorney, Judith Ablett-Kerr, asked Leslie about the relationship between Sophie and Otago University economics lecturer Robert Alexander. Leslie said that she considered Robert to be a mentor and a friend. A former girlfriend of Clayton, whose identity was suppressed, had said that Clayton was obsessed with getting a lectureship at the university and had confided in her that he felt as though Sophie had said something to Robert, who was on the selection panel for the position, and had ruined his chances to get the job. This same ex-girlfriend said that Clayton was obsessive and had a nasty demeanour, particularly while under stress. She also testified that Clayton had spoken to her about his relationship with Sophie. He had told her that the relationship was negative, and that Sophie sucked his strength and was mean to him at times. The ex-girlfriend described Clayton as hypersensitive, stating, "He would take offence where others might be able to deal with it. He gets offended easily and becomes distressed at someone thinking the worst of him." The ex-girlfriend said that she had spoken to Clayton just days before the murder had occurred, and said that he wasn't himself. She said that she was concerned and urged him to get out of the relationship. She said that Clayton appeared pleased that Sophie was moving away to Wellington, but said that she was worried about Clayton, stating, "Clearly I wasn't concerned anything untoward was going to happen, but I was concerned enough to say, I think you need a break away." She said that he described Sophie as horrible, and said he couldn't believe that he'd let her influence his life for so long. Robert Alexander, the economics lecturer, would also testify during the pre-trial hearing. He revealed that just the day before Sophie was murdered, she had told him that Clayton told her that he wished she was dead because she ruined his chances of getting a new job that he'd wanted. He revealed that just the day before Sophie was murdered, she told him that Clayton had told her that he wished she was dead because she ruined his chances of getting the new job that he wanted. He said that Sophie had often confided in him about things that Clayton had said to her, and these things made Robert feel uneasy. She told him that Clayton often belittled her, calling her stupid, fat, and ugly. He recollected how Clayton had once told Sophie that he was dating a new woman who was 5'10" and a model, who was a step up from her. He said that Clayton often made it clear that he believed he was superior to everybody else, including Sophie. He said that Clayton often suggested that his students' work was worthless and that he frequently demoralised his students. According to Robert, the real reason that Clayton didn't get the job was because he had caused trouble at the university. He made two separate accusations of plagiarism of his work, one which was against the then head of the economics department. Apparently, Clayton had very few supporters in the department. Robert told the courtroom that he'd never brought up Sophie's concerns to any other member in the department, and had only been listening to and speaking to Sophie in a personal capacity. One of Sophie's best friends, Jessica Smith, would also testify in regards to how Clayton treated Sophie. She said that he didn't treat her as an equal, and always treated her as if she was stupid. She said he often called Sophie fat and ugly, and revealed that there had been physical abuse in the relationship. She began to cry, as she recollected how, on one occasion, Clayton had picked Sophie up, took her into his bedroom, and threw her on the bed. He then got on top of her, straddled her, and had his arms against her throat. She said that Clayton was yelling at Sophie. He'd gone from saying how much he loved her and how she was the only one for him to calling her fat and ugly and telling her that she was a whore. She said that Sophie managed to get away from Clayton. She ran to her car and he ran after her, screaming that he wished her plane crashed when she flew back from her holiday in Australia. Jessica said that she tried to encourage Sophie to go to the police, but she didn't want to because she had no bruises and was leaving for Dunedin soon anyway. Under cross-examination by Defence Ablett Kerr, Jessica said that Sophie often feared that she was not attractive enough for Clayton. She asked, "Did she complain to you that it was not satisfying as a sexual relationship as far as she was concerned?" To which Jessica replied, "Yes." Another friend, Erin van der Water, testified that Sophie felt as though the relationship would be more satisfactory if she could fix the flaws that Clayton was constantly putting her down over. The court would also hear from Sarah Forbes, a friend of Clayton. She testified that on the morning of Sophie's murder, Clayton appeared to be in good spirits. It was his birthday and he was excited about the plans for his celebrations that evening. She said that Clayton had referred to Sophie as his psycho girlfriend in the past, and said that when she met Sophie, she thought she was possessive and jealous. However, when questioned about this, she said, "That was my interpretation that came about through the reputation that had been actively constructed for me. The way I saw her behaviour that night was through a lens that had been given to me." When Defence Ablett Kerr suggested she now look at it through a lens that saw Clayton kill Sophie, Sarah said, "That's not a lens, that's a fact." To which Defence Ablett Kerr replied with, "We'll see about that." She then testified that Clayton had asked her to come to his office the day before Sophie was murdered. Over the course of 2 hours, Clayton talked about Sophie. He said that he was concerned about her because she had allegedly arrived at his office the day beforehand, shaking and sweating. He claimed that she had hit him in the face with her elbow, apparently reenacting what she alleged was an earlier assault by Clayton on her. She then apparently said, "Now, we are even." He spoke about the earlier assault on Sophie, but claimed that she'd come to his home yelling and screaming and had tried to hit him repeatedly. He claimed that he'd pushed her onto the bed simply as a way to restrain her. After the 4-day pre-trial hearing, Justice of the Peace Ashley Broad told Clayton that there was sufficient evidence against him to go to trial for the murder of Sophie. He asked Clayton if he wanted to plead guilty, to which he replied, "No." The defence had applied to have the trial moved out of Dunedin, citing that it would be impossible for Weatherstone to get a fair trial there. This further delayed the process, which in 2008 was an average wait of 285 days for a trial.
The Elliott family waited an entire agonising year to face Clayton Weatherstone again at the High Court in Christchurch. The trial was delayed 2 days due to the pre-trial arguments, but finally began on the 24th of June 2009. Around 18 months after Sophie's murder. On the first day, the jury heard the opening statements from both Mary Grills, the Crown Prosecutor, and the defence, Judith Albert Kerr. The prosecution argued that Clayton's savage attack was a deliberate attempt at disfiguring and killing her. Attorney Grills revealed during her opening statements the full extent of Sophie's injuries. Up until now, the grim details of her murder had been suppressed. Sophie had been attacked with such brutality that her ears and the tip of her nose had been cut off. There were stab wounds to her eyes, her throat, her breasts, her genital area, and to other parts of her body. Some of her hair had also been cut off. Crown Counsel Grills told the jury that it was no coincidence that some of the clusters of wounds to Sophie related to areas of her beauty and attractiveness. Clayton had started the attack with the knife he had brought to the home with him, and then midway through started stabbing Sophie with a pair of scissors.
The defence case is that that is ludicrous. That what occurred was that as a result of provocation, he was deprived of his self-control, and that the tragic and horrific killing of Sophie Elliott occurred.
The defence argued that Clayton had simply lost control after dealing with abusive behaviour from Sophie for many months, and that he was ill-equipped to deal with it due to his unique personality. Clayton's defence argued that Sophie had attacked him with a pair of scissors and he simply fought back. During opening statements of defence, Albert Kerr, she essentially blamed Sophie's murder on herself. She said Clayton was ill-equipped to deal with the emotional pain of the relationship, which she referred to as torrid and tumultuous, and said that this was because of his unique personality makeup.
The deceased, no doubt, at her wit's end also with the course of the relationship, screamed out to him, "You, Clayton," lunged at him with a pair of scissors, and in the process knocked off his glasses, leaving him exposed and vulnerable.
She said that Clayton had been provoked into losing the power of self-control and killing Sophie. She said that the relationship between Clayton and Sophie had impinged his personal and professional life, and even alleged that Sophie had attacked Weatherston with a pair of scissors, and he responded by stabbing her over 200 times with a kitchen knife that he had brought along with him to her house. The defence contended it was manslaughter, not murder, and that the jury would need to focus on the behavioural aspects of both Sophie and Clayton and decide what the proper level of culpability was in the case. The jurors were warned to avoid reading or watching any media reports about the case and to focus entirely on what they had heard in court. When the charge was put to Weatherston, he was asked to respond. He replied that he was not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter. On day two, the court listened to the painful testimony of Leslie Elliott after discovering Clayton brutally murdering her daughter.
I raced upstairs at the first scream, and she just started screaming and screaming and screaming. And I belted on the door. I tried the door and it was locked. I kicked the door and belted it and screamed at Clayton to open it, but he didn't.
She described the moment she finally managed to get into Sophie's bedroom after hearing her scream. By this point, Sophie had fallen silent and all she could hear was a rhythmic sound, which she thought was the headboard banging up against the wall. She said at first she feared that Clayton was raping Sophie. When she opened the door and saw him straddling her, she testified, quote, "His arm was going up and down. I thought he was stabbing right through her. That was what the rhythmic noise was." Leslie said that she began to scream and Clayton leaned over and slammed the door. She was already on the phone to the police at this point. Leslie told the jury that as soon as she opened that door and saw her daughter, she knew that she was dead. She said that Sophie was lying on her back in the corner of the room, surrounded in a pool of her own blood. She said that her eyes were dead white and staring into nothingness. She said that she could see that Sophie was bleeding from the eyes and there was blood across her chest. She stated, "I don't know why I stepped out of the room. I wish I hadn't, but I did. He was still stabbing her. I suppose it was all a bit of a shock, really. I stepped back. I didn't resist him closing the door." She described the whole of Sophie's bedroom as being red, and that she had witnessed blood pouring from her daughter's eyes whilst Clayton continued to stab Sophie's dead body. Leslie also spoke of the previous incidents that occurred between the pair just before Sophie's death, and talked about Sophie's fear of Clayton. Leslie was then cross-examined and forced to account for Sophie's previous relationship ending sourly. It was inferred that Sophie had hit her ex-boyfriend of 4 years across the face, scratching him, but Leslie was not aware of this. Leslie said that at first she had been concerned about the relationship between Sophie and Weatherston because he was one of her lecturers. She said that the relationship was weird and unlike any other relationship Sophie had been in. She elaborated by saying that there was no usual starry-eyed and loving behaviour which is typical in the early stages of a relationship. She said that Sophie was typically very loving and cuddly, but she saw none of this in her relationship with Clayton. She said that Sophie had confided in her and that it appeared as though Weatherston led two separate lives and that he had a whole set of other people she didn't know about. Defence counsel Albert Kerr suggested that before Sophie started to scream, she had shouted, "Fuck you, Clayton." Leslie said she doubted that her daughter had said that and said that she either heard her shout, "Don't, Clayton," or "Stop it, Clayton." She accepted that she had told the police she didn't hear Sophie screaming until a couple of minutes after she last saw her downstairs. However, she had earlier said she heard Sophie screaming within seconds of her going up to her bedroom. In the following days, the jurors heard from Dr. Alexander, Sophie's senior dissertation supervisor at the University of Otago. He spoke of how Clayton had continuous problems with other members of staff. He'd accused them of plagiarism. He would be unhelpful with students, mocking them or pointing out their mistakes. Clayton was hoping to get a permanent job at the university, but he believed that Sophie had ruined this opportunity for him. However, Dr. Alexander told him that regardless of his relationship, he was unlikely to get the job anyway due to his behaviour towards other people.
It was my opinion that he had little chance based on his conflict with other members of the department, particularly in accusing two senior colleagues of plagiarism.
Weatherston had attempted to push Sophie down the stairs at the university on the 7th of January, and on the 8th, the day before she died, Sophie went to visit Dr. Alexander again to drop off the gift that she was supposed to give him the day before. He said she was upbeat and happy, but spoke of how Clayton had pushed her and screamed that he wished she was dead.
Told her that he wished her dead, that he now had a new girlfriend who was 5'10" and such a big step up from her.
Dr. Alexander mentioned involving the police, but Sophie also insisted to him that it wasn't worth it because she was leaving so soon. He said, "I regret not having insisted that she go to the police." That same day, another colleague of Weatherston's took the stand. Christine Haig, the department administrator, spoke of Weatherston's attitude the week he carried out the murder. He didn't mention anything about his attacks on Sophie in the days prior, but he did tell her that Sophie had destroyed his property and was glad the bad relationship was over. Other than that, Christine said his behaviour was normal and that she had no other concerns. Sarah Forbes, another friend of Weatherston's, testified that Sophie had added her on Facebook even though they had only met one time. She informed Clayton of this and he told her not to accept the friend request because Sophie would try and monitor her account. He had told Sarah that Sophie was very insecure with their relationship and that she was doing spot checks at his house. She would allegedly show up in the middle of the night to make sure that no other woman was staying over. Sophie's best friend Jessica Smith gave evidence next. She broke down in tears as she relayed the fears that she had that Weatherston would one day seriously harm Sophie. She said that Sophie had promised her that she would not go and see Weatherston again. Testifying, Jessica said, "I was so scared after what he had done the last time, but she wanted things resolved." The day before the murder, Sophie had told her about meeting Weatherston by chance, just the previous day. Sophie confided in Jessica that Weatherston had called her mentally deranged. Jessica also told the jury how Clayton had often called Sophie horrible names, made cruel remarks about her appearance and intelligence, and accused her of being spoiled and living off her parents, which was an insult that really hurt Sophie.
He said that her chin was too pointy, her eyes were too far apart. He said that he listed each thing individually. He said, told her to look at how disgusting she was.
She told the court that she thought the relationship was inappropriate, given that Clayton was one of Sophie's teachers. She admitted that everything she knew about the relationship was from Sophie's perspective. During cross-examination, she spoke of Sophie's dissatisfaction with Clayton sexually, and how Sophie had a sexual encounter with an Australian man when on holidays in November 2007, and then another with a Dutchman on the same holiday.
Sophie got very drunk one night and ended up in bed with a person called...
Yes.
And Sophie met up with a Dutch person, I think he's been described as Danish. And you're aware that that encounter was also involved sexual intercourse taking place?
Yes.
According to the defence, Sophie was also seeing a married man, but the relationship didn't go any further. Testimony was then heard from a former girlfriend of Clayton's, whose name was suppressed. She testified that she had been in a relationship with Clayton from 2004 to August of 2007. She said that Clayton could be kind and generous, but he had an extremely mean streak and would often say demeaning things to her about her intelligence and appearance. On one occasion, he had forced her to compare his genitalia to a former boyfriend, and when she grudgingly answered, he got angry and said, "I can't believe you'd tell me that. It's such an insensitive thing to say." On another occasion, she was attempting to sleep and Clayton was playing guitar. She had asked him several times to stop, but he ignored her requests, forcing her to put her hand on his guitar and suggest that he play elsewhere. Clayton responded by jumping up and down on top of her in the bed. She said that in 2006, she tried to break up with him and he flew into a violent rage.
And he kicked me in the back and in the ribs. And then I travelled across the floor, and next thing I knew, he jumped on the back of my neck. He at times could have a very nasty, mean streak, and he did it on various occasions, say, fairly demeaning things to me.
He kicked her, sending her flying across the room. He had also kicked her in the back, ribs and knee, and also on the nose. He then took away her keys to prevent her from leaving the house, stating that he wanted to talk about the incident. The same woman had remained in contact with Clayton after the breakup and said he was obsessed with Sophie. Two nights before the murder, he had called the woman and kept going on and on about Sophie, criticising her and saying he couldn't believe that he had let someone so negative into his life. The woman tried to calm him down, reminding him that Sophie was much younger than him, but said he wouldn't let it go. He reiterated his fears that Sophie had ruined his chances of getting the job. It was revealed during the trial that 5 days after murdering Sophie, Clayton had written a letter to the former girlfriend in jail. On the 2nd of July, the prosecution read out a letter that Clayton had sent to his ex-girlfriend just 5 days after killing Sophie. It read, "I have been better and I've also been thinking about you. This is a rough ride and it's not looking like it's getting any easier. I'm in a cell most of the day, getting some time for a shower and outside in a small yard. The food is pretty good. Knowing I have your support is crucial to me. I'm so sorry for not seeing how great you truly are. I will talk, see you and Mum and Dad as soon as possible. I'm so sorry that such a horrible person has been glorified in the media from what I've heard. That is our society. It will blow over. Not going to dwell on the uncontrollables, but rather on staying positive. There is, unfortunately, way too much time here to overanalyze. I've started to appreciate the small things in life already. I'm nervous about court on Thursday and I'm annoyed my side will not be made public. I also expect a lot of ill will. I will focus on your continued positive energy to help me through it. Don't know what I'll be wearing. You is my one. Clate. P.S. I sent Mum some visitor application forms. You need to fill one in if you want to come and visit. Thank everyone for me for their support." At the time, Clayton's ex-girlfriend had no idea of the true extent of Sophie's injuries. Details of the murder were only released to the media shortly after the letters had been sent, and she decided at that point that she wouldn't see or support Clayton again. Another former girlfriend, who also remained anonymous, testified during the trial. She testified that living with Clayton was like walking on eggshells. She said that she learned to become quite careful with him because anything could set him off. She said that the relationship was generally loving and kind, but she found it very stressful when Clayton was stressed, stating, "He had two sides, a loving and generous side and a nasty, mean side, which he seldom showed in public." She said that there was an element of fragility to his personality. This woman had actually written to Clayton following his arrest, telling him that a lot of people were rooting for him and that he should dig deep and find those coping skills. However, she quickly stopped responding after finding out the full extent of what he had done. At first, she thought it might have been a mistake, that something had happened in a moment of shock and heat. Following this evidence, the court was adjourned due to the hospitalisation of a juror. This episode is sponsored by Elfster. It's almost that time of year and nothing crushes your Christmas spirit faster than the stress of organising gifts for everyone. Elfster is the number one Secret Santa app in the world. Elfster makes giving gifts easier by allowing you to create a free gift exchange. All you have to do is set the date and budget and Elfster will take care of the rest. They even draw the names for you. You can make wish lists to share with your family and friends to make sure that everyone gets the gift they really want. You can add gifts to your wish list from your favourite brands like Amazon, Etsy, Fanatics, Nordstrom and more. You can also shop from curated gift guides. Elfster is trusted by more than 17 million people to arrange their Secret Santa gift exchange. Go to elfster.com or download the Elfster app. It's E-L-F-S-T-E-R. Elfster.
On the 7th of July, an ESR scientist, Dr. Michael Taylor, addressed the court, explaining his findings from the analysis of blood staining in Sophie's bedroom. He found three areas of intense blood staining on the carpet, blood splatter across her walls and suitcase, as well as drag marks where Sophie's body had been moved before being stabbed again. Sophie was likely already deceased when she was moved, he states. In my opinion, these findings support the view of a number of blows were struck while the deceased was on the floor near the corner of the room, and she was then dragged to the suitcase, where it is possible more blows were inflicted. Dr. Taylor also spoke of finding a pair of bent, blood-stained scissors between Sophie's legs, a knife blade inside of the suitcase, and the handle underneath Sophie's shoulders. He later assessed Clayton's flat where he discovered a knife block with one knife missing. This was later determined to be the knife used to murder Sophie. Testimony would then be presented in regards to the crime scene at the home. Detective Constable Joanne Mary McLaughlin testified that when she entered Sophie's bedroom, she found her body laying on top of an open suitcase with her legs on the floor. She spotted a small pair of black-handled scissors on the carpet between Sophie's legs. The scissors were stained with blood. Nearby, she found a silver knife which was also stained with blood. There was a large quantity of blood surrounding Sophie's body, as well as splattered on the wall in the corner and to the left of the door. The suitcase contained Sophie's clothing, which she'd been packing for the big move. A clump of hair was also found in the suitcase. There was blood evidence which indicated that Sophie had been dragged across the floor during the attack. Detective Graham Smale told the jury that when he searched Clayton's home, he found that a kitchen knife was missing from the Wiltshire knife block. He compared the knife block and the other knives to the knife that was found in the crime scene and reached a conclusion that the knife used in the murder had come from this knife block, meaning that Clayton had arrived at Sophie's home armed with a knife. On the 7th of July, pathologist Martin Sage took the stand to describe the condition of Sophie's body after her death. She died from blood loss following severe wounds to her heart and major arteries in her neck. Clayton Weatherston had cut off clumps of Sophie's hair with scissors. He'd removed parts of her ears and the tip of her nose. She had been stabbed around the face, temples and eye sockets a total of 11 times, and her throat alone was stabbed 45 times. Some of the wounds were made by the scissors with the blade closed. He'd stabbed Sophie a number of times in the breasts, cut off her nipple, and had also attempted to disfigure her genitals. In total, Sophie had suffered 216 stab and cut wounds. Dr. Sage didn't think it was a coincidence that all of the wounds targeted area of beauty on Sophie's body. Next, a police electronic analyst at the crime lab spoke of how Clayton had accessed Sophie's Facebook photo albums for several minutes before he visited her home on the 9th of January. He flicked through until around 11:39 a.m, just an hour before Sophie was pronounced dead. On the 11th day of the trial, the defence would begin presenting their case. Defence Greg King said that Sophie had slept with two men while on vacation in Australia in November. He said that when Clayton went to her house, he asked if he should be tested for an STD. He made the startling claim that Clayton didn't have his glasses with him and was therefore vulnerable. It was an extremely ludicrous claim from the defence. To stab someone over 200 times with a kitchen knife that you'd brought along with you because you couldn't see properly without your glasses. It made very little sense. It wasn't until the 9th of July 2009 that Clayton took the stand. He spoke of his insecurities in prior relationships.
I think I was probably a bit more flashy, a bit more image conscious than my brother. I was just terrified. I was terrified of being teased. I mean, now glasses are fashionable, but not back then. It was a source of differentiation and possibly derision from other people. The anxiety made me sick, so to speak. And I said, oh, how big was his sexual organ?
You asked her about the size of this man's penis, is that right?
I think I was after an ego boost for me. And insecurity.
Did you get the boost you were after?
No, not at all. The way in which it was said. But, I mean, I asked for it. I told you what the response was, right?
According to him, he'd not taken the knife to attack Sophie, but as a weapon for self-defence if she was to attack him. He claims that he only began attacking her with a knife when she shouted, "Fuck you, Clayton," and tried to stab him with the scissors, knocking off his glasses and leaving him vulnerable. Throughout his testimony, he made sarcastic remarks and grinned repeatedly. He claimed that his memory of the murder was very contained to quite small pieces of information. He said that memory is good when a person is not stressed and was in control. He said that he only had one vivid memory, and that was of a crushing sound. He said he recalled standing or kneeling over Sophie with a pair of scissors in his hand, and when asked if he killed Sophie after she attacked him with scissors, he replied, "I think in some respects it was the straw that broke the camel's back." It's quite hard to answer. After the murder, he said he felt a big release and laughed as he told the court, "I thought she was more than likely dead. Presumably, I thought. I mean, I didn't know." He claimed that when he went to Sophie's house that day, it was never his intention to kill her. He said his goal was to take the moral high ground and leave her home with her knowing that she'd behaved badly during their relationship. He said he brought up the topic of Sophie sleeping with two men while in Australia, telling the jury. She wasn't happy about that topic being raised and said that she wasn't a slut and she'd known the guy a couple of days. He claimed that as he tried to leave, Sophie came at him with a pair of scissors. When asked why he'd brought a kitchen knife with him, he claimed that he'd carried the knife in his laptop bag since the middle of 2006. Stating that he was concerned about personal safety. The prosecution also pointed out that Clayton had locked the door before attacking Sophie, which clearly indicated premeditation. While on the witness stand, Clayton would shockingly refer to Sophie as an attempted murderer, despite the fact he had no injuries to himself other than a small cut on his hand that was most likely inflicted when he was murdering Sophie. He said that he resented Sophie's contrived legacy. Prosecutor Bates would read an entry from Sophie's diary. It was dated the 27th of December, 2009. She wrote, "Lord, I hardly know where to start. Clayton assaulted me. When I went to leave, he went absolutely psycho. No exaggeration at all, I assure you. He told me I'm a fucking horrible person, everyone hates me, I'm fucking ugly, he never liked me, etc. All while pinning me down with his entire body on his bed." She wrote that she was extremely scared of Clayton and that he was furious and unreasonable. Clayton responded by stating that Sophie's version of the incident was embellished and a fantasy, stating, "It's Pride and Prejudice, you've seen it. She's Mrs. Bennet and I'm Mr. Darcy. It's Mills and Boone. This whole dramatic stuff didn't occur. The next thing I recall is standing or kneeling over her with a pair of scissors in my right hand. The scissors had gone through the front of her throat and I could feel a crunching sound. Not of them going in, but of meeting something hard, her spine." During cross-examination, he told the court that he did not find Sophie's body particularly attractive, stating, "I'm an arse man." He was asked outright if he targeted different parts of Sophie's body on purpose in an attempt to disfigure her. He claims he cannot remember any of the attack, but that disfiguring her was not his intention.
"Why did you cut parts of both her ears off?"
I don't know.
"Is it just a coincidence? They're all features of a
attractiveness.
Well, I don't... My personal view of attractiveness is that those features are not important. I suppose it's how they correlate with one another and are they aligned and everything else. You can't just have nice ears and, you know, it's the whole package. So, and that's generically, she was attractive.
Why did you cut the nipple off her breast?
I don't know.
Stab her in both eyes?
I don't know.
You remember doing all those things, I suggest?
I don't. I would have, in evidence in chief, told you everything I did.
Because you would tell the truth if you remembered it.
Absolutely.
You remembered where the knife was when the officer asked you? You remember that, don't you? You were able to convey that straight away.
I had some time before the officer came into the room, but, Mr. Bates...
go looking for the knife.
No, please.
You'd have to tell me specifically what I said in order for your question to say that I recalled.
Did you remember that where the knife was or not? How's your memory on that? Let's
I knew it was in the area around Sophie, but if you could recall the comment that I made to the officer that justifies the question, and then we'll go from there.
Plenty of time. We'll do that when we come to that
cool.
Day. You indicated, you remembered, you'd use the knife first and the scissors later? Is that something you remember?
That's something I deduced from having had the memories, as I said, of the cut on my hand, having seen the memory of, or felt the memory of the scissors. So definitely the scissors at the end and the cutting of my hand with some sort of blade, I assumed it was the knife.
You just told us you remember that you didn't lock the door. Is that correct?
At what stage?
Any stage.
Yeah, true. Yep, that's right.
So you remember that, not locking the door, is that what you're saying?
No. I don't... Okay, let's flip it around. I don't recall locking the door. I don't recall not locking the door.
You can remember everything up until the time that you say Sophie waves some scissors at you. That's basically what you've told us, isn't it?
As I say, there's something unintelligible said before she said, fuck you, Clayton. I don't recall that. I was distracted. So I don't think it's that deterministic or convenient, because it's not convenient, because I don't like being in a position where I can't answer questions. I'd rather know all the answers and be able to provide you with them rather than have a degree of cynicism about my recall. I find that a bit offensive, but that's just the way it is, Mr. Bates.
Clayton's former Otago University academic supervisor, Professor Dorian Owen, told the courtroom how just the day before Sophie was killed, he'd advised Clayton to just leave Sophie alone, stating, "I told Clayton to keep his head down as Sophie would be leaving soon. Everyone knew she was leaving and the relationship would come to an end." He said that when speaking to Clayton the day before the murder, he said that he'd been having a hard time with Sophie and that he was concerned about her temper and her outbursts. Clayton indicated to Professor Owen that he did not expect to see Sophie again. Professor Owen testified that when he heard about what happened, he was of course shocked by the actions of Clayton, but also due to the fact that he went over to her house. He described Sophie as not particularly calm or laid back, adding that she was expressive and theatrical and not afraid to talk in class. He said that she was forceful in the way that she spoke. He described Clayton as pleasant and said that he was always a very calm person. He said that Clayton had told him in the past that Sophie was controlling. Under cross-examination by Prosecutor Grills, Professor Owen denied making comments about Sophie's breast to Clayton and said that he was surprised that Clayton had attributed such a comment to him. Testimony in regards to Clayton's mental health would be presented. Dr. David Chaplow told the jury that Clayton was not mentally ill at the time of the murder, but had features of anxiety disorder, personality features of narcissism and obsessionality. He said that there were indications of considerable maladaptiveness and problems with social and other interpersonal relationships. Dr. Philip Brinded had also interviewed Clayton in prison and said that he had significant lack of empathy or remorse for the murder of Sophie, and that was evident. He testified that Clayton had taken no responsibility for what had happened during the relationship or what he had done. He also said that Clayton had attempted to control the interview by using handwritten chronology of events that he had prepared, and became increasingly anxious and resistant to questioning that forced him to deviate from the chronology. In fact, Clayton had said that Sophie was responsible for the state of affairs which he had found himself in, meaning that Sophie was responsible for her own murder. Dr. Brindid said to the jury that it was his opinion that a defence of insanity could be ruled out, as well as the idea that Clayton committed the murder in an unconscious automatic state. Dr. Brindid was the last witness to testify. Next up were closing arguments. Prosecutor Bates said that Clayton had attempted to rewrite history in a bid to avoid responsibility for what he'd done. He said that Clayton had told different people different things about his relationship with Sophie, adding that just days before she was murdered, Clayton had told her that he wished she was dead. He reminded the jury that Clayton went to Sophie's house, armed with a knife, and had locked the door, stating that he'd clearly decided to kill her and didn't want to be disturbed. Countering this, Defence Ablett Kerr said that Clayton was provoked to the point that he lost all self-control. There were audible gasps in the courtroom, and some in attendance even stormed out when she suggested that Leslie was not a reliable witness, because what she saw that day must have traumatised her.
Jurors began deliberating on the 21st of July. While summing up the case, Justice Judith Potter said to the jury that the pivotal issue in deciding whether Clayton was guilty or not was whether the defence of provocation had been excluded. Since Clayton had admitted to manslaughter but denied murder, two questions for the jury were whether Clayton had killed Sophie with murderous intent, and if so, had the Crown proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not acting under provocation. Murderous intent is an essential element of a murder charge, and the jury needed to look at the evidence presented carefully. They were told to take their time and weigh up the evidence clinically. After 4 hours of deliberations, they were sent home for the day. The next morning, Leslie Elliott spoke to reporters outside of the court. She said, "It is difficult to convey the extent of these feelings to those that have not experienced the sudden death of a loved one in this horrendous manner. It has not been easy to sit daily in court and listen not only to graphic forensic evidence, but also to distortions and embellishments of the truth about Sophie and her life. As painful as it had been for the family, it is nowhere near the horror that Sophie faced in the last minutes of her life. Our lives will never be the same, but we are fortunate to have the unwavering support of family and friends. They have been our strength." Not long after entering the court that day, the foreman of the jury informed judges that they had reached a verdict. Clayton Weatherstone was found guilty of murder. The court erupted in cheers, shouting, and sighs of relief. Weatherstone didn't react. He stood there emotionless until he was led away. Outside of the courtroom, the defence attorney hugged both Gil and Leslie. Weatherstone's mother, Eileen Weatherstone, also hugged Leslie. Leslie and Gil made a brief statement, stating that what Clayton had done had come as a great shock to them, but said that they hoped he got the help he needed while he was behind bars. Following the verdict, Women's Refuge in New Zealand spoke of their disappointment about the way intimate details of Sophie's life were exposed to everybody, and how the blame was repeatedly shifted back to her. Her name was dragged through the mud in front of thousands, and her parents were extremely disappointed with this too. Her father, Gilbert Elliott, argued that the provocation defence should be scrapped entirely, and the Women's Refuge backed this option. They stated, "Because of the way the defence was run, this trial became a perverse opportunity for a killer to continue to persecute his victim and her family after her death. The provocation defence is based on absolutely archaic notions about violence. Once upon a time, society accepted that an affront to male privilege or dignity was a reasonable excuse to fly into a homicidal rage. This trial turned justice inside out. The killer became the victim, and Sophie Elliott was portrayed to us all as he chose to describe her. Unfortunately for Weatherstone, the jury didn't buy it, nor did the hundreds of thousands of New Zealanders who watched him giggling on their televisions." Over the following weeks, this campaign to change the law was led by Sophie's parents, the Women's Refuge, and the Sensible Sentencing Trust, and was backed entirely by the Prime Minister of New Zealand. In September 2009, just days before Clayton was due to be sentenced, Leslie and Gilbert were asked by reporters about what kind of outcome they were hoping for. Leslie said, "Obviously, I think that punishment has to be punishment. Little kids do something wrong, they get punished. And big kids are the same, especially arrogant ones. If it's a good, long, non-parole period, maybe 20 years plus, I think we will probably be reasonably satisfied. I think from our point of view, we need..." People use the word closure. I don't like the word, but it's probably the best description, really. "I think we just need to move on so that we can think about Sophie and not think about all that other stuff as well." On the 15th of September, the family walked into court for the last time to face Clayton. Justice Potter stated, "I am no doubt that this murder was committed with a high degree of callousness and brutality. I consider it entirely relevant and appropriate to take into account the prisoner's actions in continuing to attack after she was dead, including the deliberate and gross mutilation of her body. The continuing attack was very much part of the circumstances of her death. I consider they are likely readily to have reached the conclusion that his killing of Sophie Elliott was not the result of his losing the power of self-control, but rather the deliberate and controlled attack on a young woman who he had made known to others he hated." Sophie's family were able to provide impact statements. Leslie revealed that she had undergone hours of counselling for flashbacks of Sophie's murder. She said that she had hopes that one day she'll be able to think of Sophie how she was when she was alive, and not the image she had and her daughter in her head, pale and covered in blood. Leslie said that she still cried herself to sleep at night and had to take medication to keep functioning on a daily basis. Turning to Weatherston, she said, "Clayton Weatherston, this is what you have done. I hope her screams of agony ring in your ears as they do in mine." Gil said that he was still struggling to come to terms with what had happened to Sophie, stating, "Everything I had existed for stopped that day." He said that Sophie had been mutilated so badly that they had been advised not to see her before her funeral. Speaking directly to Clayton, he said, "You are the epitome of evil." The defence counsel told the courtroom that Clayton had told her he understood that people did not see he was remorseful for what he had done, and that he had heard much of what people had said about him. She said that Clayton had told her that people who say these things don't see him at 2 a.m. in the morning, when he thinks about the horrendous thing that occurred, stating, "He tells me he is sorry, that he saw no point in saying it himself, because it would appear contrived." Finally, Justice Potter sentenced Clayton to 18 years in prison, with no chance of parole. Again, Clayton showed no emotion, not as the sentence was read out, or when hearing the victim impact statements from both of Sophie's parents. Throughout the whole ordeal, he had not shown one shred of remorse. Although the Elliott family were not entirely pleased with the sentence, they were now able to move on with their lives, and could finally focus on grieving for their beautiful daughter instead. Following the sentencing, Justice Minister Simon Power took heed to what Gill had said about the provocation defence and announced that killers could no longer use it. In November of that year, the defence of provocation was abolished.
After months of healing, Leslie decided to use Sophie's story as a means for change and made a simple but effective PowerPoint presentation about Sophie's story. She took this presentation to schools in the area, including Sophie's former school, and asked the head teachers if she was able to have an hour of the students' time. They agreed, and eventually, Leslie no longer had to invite herself. The schools were honoured to have her tell Sophie's story. In October 2010, Leslie decided to take the next step and set up the Sophie Elliott Foundation. The three main aims of the foundation: educating young people about the dangers of unsafe, violent and abusive relationships, empowering young people to take positive action, equipping young people with the skills needed to identify early warning signs and the resources and support necessary to avoid becoming involved in unsafe, violent and abusive relationships. By 2013, Leslie had partnered up with the New Zealand Police to develop a workshop specifically for Year 12 students named Loves Me Not. The workshop reflected all of the main aims of Sophie Elliott Foundation: educating young adults about the dangers of abusive relationships. On the 10-year anniversary of Sophie's murder, Gilbert and Leslie spoke to the media about the importance of spreading awareness about domestic abuse and how at least 8 women had expressed to Leslie directly that Sophie's story had encouraged them to leave their violent partners. Unfortunately, in August 2019, Leslie decided to close the foundation after suffering for many years with Parkinson's disease. She physically was unable to carry on. She decided to hand the responsibility of the Loves Me Not workshop over to the police and stated that she did not want somebody else taking control of Sophie's image via the foundation. She felt that the work she'd carried out already would make an enormous difference. Since he was charged and sentenced, Clayton Weatherstone has exhausted every appeal he has available to him, all of which were thankfully declined. Clayton Weatherstone was a predator and an abuser. The signs in Sophie and Weatherstone's relationship were not glaringly obvious, and it became her mother's mission to make sure that people can recognise an abusive relationship as soon as possible. The case not only highlighted the outdated defence of provocation, but helped bring an end to it. Sophie Elliott would have done amazing things in her life, and she has inspired amazing things since her death. Clayton Weatherstone will not be eligible for parole until 2026. Hopefully, he'll spend longer than that behind bars. A special mention to the books that Leslie Elliott has written, Loves Me Not and Sophie's Legacy, we'll have links in our bio for them. They were incredibly informative and heartbreaking in equal measure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Crime Lapse. Crime Lapse is an independent podcast that is funded in part by our generous Patreon supporters. If you enjoy the show and want to help us keep it going, you can join us on patreon.com/crimelapse. And in exchange for your pledge, you'll get access to early release, ad-free episodes, bonus content, and exclusive merchandise. You can also support the show by subscribing and leaving us a 5-star review. You can keep up to date with us on social media at CrimeLapse on Instagram and Facebook, and at CrimeLapsePod on Twitter. Stay safe.